The Fidelity Bank Power Plug podcast for women in business is now live on radio.com. Plug in and listen today. You can hear everything from rebranding your business or growing it with special events. The podcasts are filled with real-life stories and interviews from business owners just like you. There's a new topic every month. Fidelity Bank believes in your power and is here for you and here for good. To learn more about the Fidelity Bank Power Program, log on to fidelitybankpower.com. Member FDIC.
Welcome to Our House, the only complete on-air resource for your home ownership needs. Now, here's the host of Our House, Peter Hunt.
Good morning and welcome to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and this show is brought to you by the all-new huntrealestate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience. I encourage you to go there today. We're constantly upgrading and improving it. This show will be on our blog following Monday so that you can catch up with it if you'd like. And it's also on our podcast at Our House. So anyway, huntrealestate.com is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA here in Buffalo, Niagara, all across upstate to Boston, Massachusetts now, and even out to Phoenix, Arizona. The show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage. Call them today, 633-3700. Ask one of our skilled mortgage consultants to work with you to find the lowest rate and closing costs for your particular home financing needs and wants, and that's our guarantee. Also ask about our many exclusive programs, including our pre-purchase commitment that allows you at no cost or risk to effectively enter the market to find your next home with cash. And in today's very competitive listing environment where we don't have enough inventory, when you do find the house you want, you want to make sure that you compete with all the other offers, including the ones that say cash on them. And that's the best way to do that is through our pre-purchase commitment. So call Hunt Mortgage today, 633-3700, and seek out that personalized, customized, knock-your-socks-off service that's only available there. And don't forget about the first-ever 24/7, 365 real estate hotline, the Hunt Hotline, which gives you all access to all available information about any property listed for sale here in Buffalo, Niagara, all across upstate, and even out to Phoenix, Arizona. Simply dial 716-631-4800. Enter the street. That's our local number, by the way. Enter the street number of the house you want to know about, no matter whose listing it is, and the hotline will prompt you with a choice of street name. Select the one you want. You'll hear a brief description, and then you'll be texted a link to a dedicated website on that property, all automatically and just that fast, anytime in any market we serve on any listing. Whether it's ours or any other brokers, you'll drive by signs with pictures and 14 phone numbers and text numbers and everything else. Ignore it. Just dial 631-4800. We have a very active marketplace right now, and I encourage you to investigate that market. The best way to do that is to stop into one of our many open houses and meet one of our professionals and ask them about the marketplace, the house you may be looking at, and what else might be available. And when you do get to that point, you'll want to ask them about the seller security plan. They're the only real estate professionals in the marketplace who can look in the eye and say, we will sell your home or ERA will buy it. That is the seller security plan available only through Hunt Real Estate ERA agents. Hunt is the official real estate and relocation provider for our hometown professional teams, the Buffalo Bills, the Buffalo Sabres, and even the Rochester Americans, and we also support the Bisons. We are broadcast live here on WBEN 930 AM, and if you'd like to participate in today's show, call us here in the studio at 803-0930 or 1-800-616-9236 if you're long distance, and star 930 if you're mobile. You can also text us here at 30930. Those are all free calls or free opportunities to join us here on the air at Our House. We have a very special show for you today. In live remote, I was going to say in the studio, live remote from Austin, Texas, we have a gentleman who's a journalist, an author, and even an investment guy, I guess that's the best way to term it. And he's recently released a book. Joining us from Austin, Texas, is Mr. Steve Hanna. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Peter.
It's good to have you with us.
Likewise, I have one question before we start.
Sure, sure.
Do I have to buy a house or take out a mortgage or anything in order to appear on the show?
If you did, you'd be, I wouldn't have many guests. So no, that's not one of the criteria. All you have to do is share your marvelous insights with us. That's all I ask of you.
All right, I just wanted to get that straight before we start.
Now, having said that, the mission of the show is to help our listeners protect and enhance their investment in real estate, you know, here where we live in Western New York. And that goes to your roots. You are actually from Penyon, or you grew up in, you started your life in Penyon, I should say. And there's an interesting story about how you actually are still alive with us today. You want to share that with us?
Yeah, my dad was a World War II veteran who had managed to survive D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge and almost didn't survive Peng Yan. When I was about 2 years of age, I was downtown shopping with my parents, and My mother went across the street to the drugstore and told my father to watch me, which he didn't. And I darted into traffic on Main Street, right into the path of some oncoming cars, and people began to scream, and my father finally paid attention and ran out into the street and dove and pushed me out of the way of the car. And for his efforts, he had his left arm, and he was a lefty, which he reminded me for the rest of my life, broken in 7 places. Wow. So it was a small town, and one small boy was almost subtracted from the population then.
Well, we're glad your father did that, because from there, you grew up, not there, but you spent some time, actually much of your time in the suburbs of New York City. And then ended up in the Midwest, but along the way you attended Colgate University, which is part of our listening audience here, and spent some time in that wonderful part of the country. How do you feel about our part of the world, Mr. Anna?
Well, it's gorgeous. I mean, and it reminds me very much of where I've been for the last 40 years, which is Wisconsin. You know, it's I think a beautiful physical piece of land. And rural New York State is a lot like America's Dairyland, frankly. And I lived for many years in Milwaukee. And Milwaukee, I've been to Buffalo many, many times. And Milwaukee, we always say, is Chicago without the hassle. And I think Buffalo is very, very similar to that.
Well, it certainly is. We consider ourselves, we're in New York State, so people would say we're part of the Northeast. But most of us who know better know that we are the most eastern part of the Midwest, and that's something that we take a certain amount of pride in because of the nature of our people here, which is really the, I guess, the core of your recently released book, Dairylandia. So why did you write that book, Steve?
I thought it was a good time, given the political and social and just generally dysfunctional state of affairs in the world. I thought it was a good time to write a book about good people. Because, I mean, you don't have to look farther than the front page of your newspaper if you're still subscribed to a newspaper. But certainly, if you're on the web and or if you're watching television, the world is run amok. There's just a constant drumbeat and assault of bad news. And I spent part of my career, Peter, I think you know, as the CEO of The Onion, which I don't need to remind anyone is America's finest news source, and it's all entirely true. Nothing was ever made up. And during that time, you know, I had a lot of interesting. Well, actually, it was just conflict really with people we wrote about. But it was the digital world, and it was the social media world, because we converted from, when I started running the company, we had 19 newspapers. And by the time I was finished, I had destroyed all the newspapers. No, that's not entirely true. But we converted to a digital model because that's where the advertising went. And I could sort of see, we had 10 million Twitter followers. I could see the effects of this. This is part of my premise here. I could see the effects that social media was having on the world, on my employees, for that matter. And I mean, you know, the president is being impeached. The Britons don't know up from down. I could go on and on. But for years prior to running The Onion, I wrote a syndicated column called State of Mind, and it was really just a conversation I had with people, usually in Wisconsin, but elsewhere in the Midwest, about their lives. And going from the East Coast, where I grew up and went to school, although Colgate was in rural New York, moving to the Midwest was really a breath of fresh air for me, and a surprise. New York City was high-powered, high-octane, loud, extraordinarily ambitious, I got to the Midwest, and maybe people in the Midwest won't appreciate it this morning, but it was quieter, it was more civilized, and certainly physically, compared to where I grew up, it was just breathtakingly beautiful and populated with people who were, among other things, humble, really kind, civilized, humble. And it's a story about after writing 600 or 700 columns, it's a story about 30 of those people that I met along the way who I thought would be good models of behavior, civility, and just the way to live a decent life. That sounds high-minded, but in fact, that's what motivated me.
You mentioned social media along the way in your discussion just now, Steve. And this is something that interests me greatly, because over the years, radio, like we're experiencing right now, has basically, there's too much stuff out there to have people focus on fairly traditional media as they used to. How do you see this evolving, if at all, beyond the current state of what I would consider to be media confusion, and really what it's done to newspapers, as you described it? You described basically what you did with those 19 newspapers that you were in charge of. But that really kind of begs the question of where you think society is going in terms of how they get their information. What do you see happening from your vast experience as a journalist and editor, and also obviously CEO of The Onion?
Well, that's a loaded question, Peter.
You're right, and I want your sage advice.
I see more of the same coming, frankly. I think part of your question was that what has happened to newspapers. Mm-hmm. The newspaper world has been really decimated. And now most of the newspapers in the country are just in the hands of a few people. And I travel around a lot. I was in four or five places this week. And the newspapers, I was in Wisconsin. I was in Dallas. I was in West Palm Beach. And those were places that had thriving newspapers in Milwaukee, in Dallas, and the Palm Beach Post. And those newspapers are just reed thin now. And they're filled with national news, which you can get almost everywhere on every broadcast. Mm-hmm. Because in many ways, I'll just simplify it, that's cheap to get. What I worry about is that local news and local news coverage, which isn't always the sexiest in the world. I mean, from the local zoning board of appeals to the school board, the kind of news that affects people directly, affects their taxes, that news is disappearing because it's expensive to produce local news. But I fear that eventually that will fade away, although there are new models that are under construction in some places. One of them down here in Texas, the Texas Tribune, which is running on millions of dollars worth of grants from civic-minded people who want to see local news covered. But without that kind of public input and without the kind of money behind it, I fear for the democracy of the country and the exchange of ideas locally and informed citizenry. In my years at The Onion, I and the people who worked there were brilliant. The comedy writers were absolutely the smartest people I ever worked with. But I often would end up interviewing them before they got hired, and I would ask this simple question that, of course, was asked of me, and now I'm an old-timer, when I first started working. Often people would ask me, what are you reading during the course of an interview? Or what's your favorite book? And when I asked that question, people, very smart people with degrees from very, very prestigious institutions, would look at me as if I was a lunatic. What do I read? I read the news feed on my telephone. That's what I read.
You know, this is very interesting to me because I travel a little bit too, and as I go places, I kind of have my own little measure as I look around, and I watch as people spend so much time on their phone and how disconnected they are, physically running into each other because they're not paying attention where they're going, just because they're so absorbed in something on their phone. And as you pointed out earlier, you said more of the same, and I see it because every once in a while, obviously, we see yet another device come out, which is more sophisticated by light years than the last one that was out.
Yeah,
which more contains more and more stuff that I don't know how people have any time to even see all that stuff. But the effect of this that I see, and I'd like your comments on this, and you alluded to it a little while ago, not necessarily in this way, but it seems as though this is creating an enormous explosion of tribalism all across the world, and where I'm right and you're wrong, and I just don't see how that's evolved, how that can evolve to get better when we're bombarded with stuff that just reinforces what we happen to think. How do you see that? Am I wrong in that assessment?
No, I think you're entirely right. I mean, I think that the politics of the country and in the world. I mean, you look at France, look at Great Britain, you name the country, are polarized. I mean, just dramatically polarized. And people get information not the way information used to be dished out, where you asked both sides. I'm going to make this really simple. You ask when an event happens, you ask one side what happened, you ask the other side what happened, and then it's your obligation to report both sides and let people who are reading it, and I'm talking about the news columns now, not the editorial pages, mm-hmm. people make up their mind based upon the best facts you can give them. Today, whether it's CNN on one side of the political divide, or it's Fox News on the other side, or those thousands and thousands of news operations in between, everybody has picked a side. And people want, I found just in my very ordinary life, that people want their point of view reinforced every single day. They're not really interested in what the other has to say. And I mean that for the left and the right. And I happen to occupy the middle ground here. I think it's years of being a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people are in search of having their views ratified rather than gathering as much information from all parties and then trying to come to some sensible conclusion and make up their own mind. I think, you know, in many ways they've already made up their own mind. And that's the way the news operations are constructed today, which I think is pathetic, frankly. How's that?
That's pretty serious. I one person said to me this week that they liked listening to the show because they liked my point of view. One of the things I've tried to do is not necessarily express my point of view and do, as you have discussed, try to bring people on the show that have a perspective on something going on in our community or elsewhere like you, and share that. And my job, I believe, is to question them and to probe into how they got to where they are in their thinking, not necessarily to spout off what I think. And because anybody could ask me and I'll tell them, but that's not what the purpose of the show is. We do have a caller on the line, Steve, and let us take this call. This is Gustav from Williamsville. Gustav, how can we help you?
Thank you. do you think that the narrowness of the perspectives that is being enabled by the electronics and the social media has any antidote even in so-called liberal arts colleges, or are they becoming like silos also without, say, the traditional or an embracing universal educational breadth to them?
How would you react to that, considering you went to one of those liberal arts schools, Steve?
I went to one of those liberal arts schools, absolutely. I think, you can read the news columns today and find out what's happening in liberal arts colleges. I mean, they're under assault, I think, from within. They want to bring a speaker. When we were at Colgate, we brought speakers from across the spectrum. I remember Secretary of State William Rogers during the Vietnam War, to Muhammad Ali, who I once had the opportunity to drive to the Syracuse airport after he gave his talk, and he left his beautiful camel's hair coat in my car.
Really? Wow.
Which I should have held on to because it'd be very valuable today.
It certainly would.
That could have made my career. But in any event, we invited people from both ends of the political and social spectrum, and I thought it was extraordinarily healthy. Nowadays, I wish I could think of a good example for the moment, but nowadays, if you you can see it at the University of Texas, you can see it at Swarthmore, I'm just out in California, I think it was University of California, Davis. They invite somebody, and someone in the student body or a bunch of someone's in the student body don't agree with this particular person's point of view. It doesn't represent their politics or their views, and so they try to get the university, and sometimes successfully, to deny this person a spot on the dais at their at the university, which is supposed to be this marketplace of thought. And I think it's just awful, frankly. I think it's a reflection of what's going on, of course, elsewhere in the world and the media at large. But I don't think that's how people get properly educated and come to a conclusion based upon the facts. You have to listen to people on both sides of the divide.
The facts of the matter, though, unfortunately, are that the divide is there, and unfortunately, it's heavily weighted on one side. And so there's a lot of parents out there that are reluctant to send their children to schools where they know the indoctrination process will be deep and thorough. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. Again, I think this is just another variation on the theme that, you know, we are pushed into corners, and we are, I think, Peter, you said tribalism at first. We have our own tribe, and we feel most comfortable with our tribe. And so if we grow up in a household or in a community that thinks a certain way, then it's a good thing for us to go to university, where we're supposed to get our brains opened up. But instead, we go to some place that mirrors what we've been taught and just reinforces. And we just never get exposed to the other side, for better or for worse. And I think that's troubling.
What we're going to do in the next segment, Mr. Hanna, is to explore the other side of that, which you explore in your book. And that is about people that have, as you describe, a resume of values. The other side of the eulogy values, not resume values. And we'll be right back with more from Our House to Yours after these important messages. Welcome back to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the all-new HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience. HuntRealEstate.com is the only place in the web where you can find a complete inventory of homes, not just available here in Buffalo, Niagara, but also all across upstate, even out to Phoenix, Arizona, and Boston, Massachusetts, through our links. And you also find access to a complete set of homeownership services at HuntRealEstate.com, which is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA. The show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, and for more information about our many exclusive programs, including the one that allows you to roll the cost of home improvements into your mortgage, allowing you to effectively buy the before but live the after. And in a community like ours, and really all across upstate, where we've got a variety of housing, including some older housing stock, sometimes you fall in love with all that beautiful, those beautiful architectural features, and then next thing you know, you've got a bunch of surprises. This type of mortgage allows you to know what you're in for in advance and to roll the costs into your mortgage so that the surprises are limited. 633-3700. Ask for details. Also ask about our pre-purchase commitment that I mentioned earlier. And even our warm home loan only at Hunt Mortgage. 633-3700. And if you have a question about anything relative to real estate, call the Hunt Customer Service Center, the only one of its kind in North America. 633-9400. Ask one of our customer service reps to answer your question or direct you to the appropriate professional for whatever it is you may need, whether you're considering buying or selling a home, financing a home, insuring a home, or even fixing up the one you have. And remember, our guarantee stands. We will sell your home or ERA will buy it. That's the seller security plan available only through Hunt Real Estate ERA Professional. We have a very special show for you today. Live remote from Austin, Texas is Mr. Steve Hanna, who is a writer, a columnist, and eventually was an editor of the Milwaukee Journal, and then became marketing executive in an investment business, and finally one of the owners of this and CEO of The Onion, which you may all be familiar with, I believe, anyway. And Steve, before the break, welcome back, by the way, and before the break, we were talking about some pretty dark stuff. And I guess I'd like to take a...
I don't know how we got into that, Peter.
I led you there, Steve. I'll take full blame for that.
I'm easily led. That's the problem.
So I'm going to ask you to take a very positive turn here and go back to... And we just started talking about... Go back to your book, Dairylandia. Tell us... You told us why you wrote it, but give us a little more depth in terms of what's inside the covers.
Well, it's a collection of 33 vignettes, really, and most of them, they all involve, my participation with people I met along the way in my career. I met, whether it was with the Journal or whether it was, I worked for CBS News right out of college. So whether it was CBS, the Journal, or it was The Onion, I had an opportunity. We were making television shows by the time I left The Onion for Comedy Central and IFC and Amazon. So I had a chance to meet a lot of, let's just call them famous people. Certainly in my straight news career, I met presidents and senators and celebrities. But I found that, particularly when I started writing Dairylandia, that I was most attracted during the years, 12 years that I wrote the column. And I wrote so many columns about ordinary people. I actually, in the book, refer to them as extraordinary, ordinary people because they were such an astonishing breath of fresh air. And I thought they had a real handle on life. They weren't trying to impress anyone. They weren't trying to get a leg up on anyone. They tended to be reticent. They tended to be kind. They tended to be courageous when it was called for. And I think most of all, they had this inherent or innate understanding of the word humility, which is understanding where any individual fits in the grand scheme of things, which is in a very small little place. These were naturally humble people. This is not sort of the world that I grew up on. I grew up in in metropolitan New York. It was aggressive. It was loud. It was very ambitious. Wonderful people, mind you, but it was a different culture. So I had a bit of a culture shock when I arrived in the Midwest. I found a different kind of community altogether. And for a guy who was really inculcated and indoctrinated with this one kind of culture, like get ahead in the world, make money. God forbid you should get famous, but that would be good too. I suddenly found these people who were modest and humble, and I was fascinated by them, frankly. So the book is really about them. I want to make, I'll say something about, you made a reference to eulogy and resume values. Those are terms that I did not make up. I want to give credit where credit's due. But I started thinking about writing this book about good people and the characteristics of good people back in the year 2000 when a book agent who was in Minneapolis and my column ran in the Twin Cities, among other places, wrote me a letter and said, I've made a list of these columns that involve these people. And there's a through line here. You seem to be attracted to people who are self-actualized. And being a really smart guy with a degree from Colgate, I immediately went to the dictionary, or I Googled it, frankly, and found out what it meant. I had no idea. But in my estimation, my interpretation, what it meant was people who were comfortable with themselves and people who were just good neighbors, or people who, as my old next-door neighbor Bill Beach used to say, people you'd like to have in your foxhole. And for whatever reason, probably because I wasn't one of those people, I gravitated to writing about them. And so then I went off to a number of different jobs. And while I guess that's when I took over the Onion around that time. And I remember in, I think it was 2015, David Brooks, who's the so-called conservative columnist for the New York Times, wrote a book called The Road to Character. Mm-hmm. Read his book, and in the book he says there are two kinds of people in the world. There are resume people, and of which he was one, he freely admitted. And those are people who are involved or who are obsessed with money, with celebrity and notoriety and getting ahead in the world and ambition. And he said, that's me. He said, I've got a column in the New York Times, and I'm kind of a blowhard by his own admission. And I'm on PBS every week, and I give my opinions, and I get paid for it. And he said, then there are these other kind of people, and these people are what I call the people who have eulogy values. You know, they at the risk of repeating myself, they're kind, they're civilized, they're brave, they're good to their neighbors, and they're humble and modest people. And he said, and the premise of the book was, what do you want to be at the end of your life? Do you want to be, when they stand over your, when they stand over the grave, or when you're in the church at your funeral, people are going to get up and say, Peter Hunt made a lot of money, or Steve Hanna achieved a certain level of notoriety as CEO of The Onion, and that's basically what they say about you? Or would you rather say, Peter or Steve, they were kind, they were good neighbors, they came to me at moments when I was under great stress, and he said, those are called eulogy values. That's what we want. That's what we ought to aim for. And what Brooks did was go back through time, and he profiled a bunch of people he thought had overcome certain difficulties and achieved that. Among George Marshall, the Marshall Plan fame, Eisenhower, Dorothy Day, a variety of people. And I realized when I read that, first of all, I said, I never should have taken this job at The Onion. I should have written that book. This guy's already written his book. But I realized that Brooks people were really famous people who had those wonderful, redeeming human qualities. My people were ordinary people who didn't make a name for themselves or exercise those eulogy traits on the world's great political and social and theatrical stages, but sort of quietly around home, and so I decided, despite the fact that David Brooks had beat me to the punch, I was going to write this book anyway, and write about not exactly butchers and bakers and candlestick makers, but my people were people who, when I would approach them to write a column about them over those years, they would always often say to me, you want to put my story in the newspaper or in all these newspapers? And incidentally, do you actually get paid for doing this? And I would say yes, but not well. So that was the difference. And there's a story that sort of summarizes sort of this book in a way. When I was out in New York doing business, and my late mother lived in New Jersey, and I went to see her one day, and we were watching television, and there was a guy on television who had won the New Jersey lottery. I think he won $100,000. And the guy got on TV and he said, I'm the man. I won $100,000. Everybody in the neighborhood knows about it. Everybody knows I've got the luck. It was my turn. I'm entitled to it. And the guy was kind of full of himself. I hope it sounds like that.
It does.
Went back to Wisconsin, and I read a little story in the newspaper about a strip of land in a little city in east central Wisconsin called Fond du Lac. And in that little city, in a brief period of time, three or four people had won large sums of money in the Wisconsin lottery. And so I thought this would make a good a good column. So I went to Fond du Lac, and the first guy I met had won a mere $10 million, and he was a factory worker at Evinrude, and an hourly worker. And I said to him, you know, congratulations, and what are you going to do with $10 million? And he looked at me, and he said, you know, I think I'm going to buy one of those KitchenAid blenders. Like to cook. And I said, that's it? And he said, so far, yeah, that's pretty much it. So, slight contrast there. I went down the road, and I met a junior high school teacher, and the junior high school teacher had won $100 million. And in my best Barbara Walters moment, I said to him, how does it feel to win $100 million? And he looked at me and he said, not too bad. And I actually got in a dispute with the publisher because when it came to naming the book, I wanted to call the book Not Too Bad. Because, you know, I'm sure that guy, that junior high school teacher, took his family to Ponderosa that night, or whatever they want, but he wasn't going to talk it up because they're among the humble and among the modest people. And I find this, you can find it, I should say, anywhere between the two coasts. There are good people anywhere. Many of my good people happen to come from Wisconsin because I was living there. There's just this notion that, they're just sort of naturally humble and naturally modest. And there's also, I think this is bred into them. There's this idea that if you brag, and, you know, the old expression, nature trips us when we strut, but if you talk it up, somehow it's going to be taken away from you. So you just ought to keep your mouth shut and be quiet about it. And that was the contrast. And those people, I really felt, were a eulogy people. They had good, down-to-earth, bedrock, Midwestern, I think, I often say, values. I'm sure they have them in Western New York.
We do.
As I said, and Yan certainly reminds me of many small towns that I visited in Wisconsin and Minnesota, Michigan, Iowa. Just good, solid people who are not getting carried away by the tide of this need for celebrity, which gets back to your comment about social media.
Steve, I have to stop you right there. We have to go to a break, but I want you to hold that thought. We also have a caller in lines. I'd like you to stay in line, if you would, please. We'll get back right to both of you right after these very important messages from our house to yours. Welcome back to our house. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the all-new huntrealestate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and homeownership experience. And the show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage. And Hunt Mortgage is the home of the low rate and closing cost guarantee and also the pre-purchase commitment. Call them today, 633-3700. I'm having, anyway, a very interesting discussion with a gentleman who is in Austin, Texas right now. He is an author, he is a journalist, he is a columnist, and he's also been an executive editor of the Milwaukee Journal, and was one of the owners and CEO of The Onion. And it's an interesting perspective we don't often get on this show. And so, first of all, Steve, thank you very much for being part of the show today. But before we get back to what you were talking about, and I have a bunch of other questions for you, we have a caller on the line. This is Anne from Amherst. Anne, how can we help you?
Okay, I was just wondering, Mr. Hanna maybe kind of alluded to this, but I was wondering what his opinion was of the culture of Buffalo, whether it was East Coast, Midwest, some combination, whatever. Thank you.
Interesting.
I think, for the sake of our conversation, and really this is reflected in the book, I think there's New York City, I'm going to really simplify it, and there's Los Angeles, two places I've spent an inordinate amount of time during my career, during my life, and I think there's everything else in between. In fact, when I wrote the book, my daughter, who's in the public relations and marketing business, said, the right title for this book, Dad, is not Dairylandia. It's not too bad. It's Between Two Coasts. And so to that point, Buffalo lies between two coasts. Buffalo is so much more I lived in Chicago for years too. Buffalo is so much more like the Midwest than it is like New York City or Los Angeles. That I'm sure that comes as no surprise. But when I go to Buffalo, I feel very much at home. I feel that I might as well be in Milwaukee, or even though Chicago's a big city, it's a city of neighborhoods. And so the answer to your question is, I think the culture of Buffalo, it's sort of hard work, straight shooting. And of course, I think the Bills, particularly this year, resemble my Packers. How's that?
I think that's fabulous, because we hope they resemble not necessarily Packers of today, but the Packers of the past, because we've got hopefully a good run in front of us. But tomorrow's going to be a tough game for the Bills. I think you'd acknowledge that.
Yes.
That Packers, the Steelers defense is awesome, and they got a record number of sacks, which is going to be tough on poor Josh, because he got pounded last week. So we'll hope that our offensive line is up to the task and keeps them safe, and that we can pull that one off. But let's get back to the matter at hand, if I can, for a second here with you, Mr. Hanna. Way back when I was a kid, I was in church, and we had a tremendous pastor at that time, and we still do today. But he spoke about two things that you allude to in your discussion of the people that you met through your book and talk about through your book. He talked about pride versus humility. And now every time I look at a press release and from some companies, they're very proud to announce, or proud to this, proud of that, proud of that. I think about what he said. He said that pride was a very dangerous emotion. That was summarizing a fairly long sermon. But he said it was the opposite of humility, which is something that you allude to, not directly, but you mentioned you use the word humility. How do you... Are they mutually exclusive, feeling proud of yourself versus being humble for what many gifts we've received? And at this time of year, I think it's also important to consider these things.
I don't know that they're mutually exclusive. I think we're all very frail human beings. And I think it's entirely possible to be proud of yourself, to be even prideful. I don't think that's the most attractive quality of a human being, but I think you can be occasionally prideful, but you ought to be mostly humble, because as I said at the outset of the show, in the grand scheme of things, we all, no matter what we accomplish on this earth, geez, I sound like somebody's, this sounds like a sermon.
Go ahead.
I think in the grand scheme of things, and at the end of the day, we're much better off adopting humility, frankly, because we really don't occupy a great and important space in the history of the world, or the history of this country, or the history of this decade. And I think if we would just remember that, it would be terrific. And if we would stop inventing, as people do these days, personal brands, or I should say manufacturing personal brands on social media, being in this virtual world,
it's crazy,
encourages people to just memorialize every significant and insignificant moment of their lives. I just don't think this is very healthy. So,
Steve, in your note to me from some time ago, you mentioned that on your book tour, you have the opportunity to actually read, or you're asked to read an excerpt of your book. We've got about 6 minutes left in the show. Do you have a excerpt that you'd like to share with us?
I do. That'd be great, Peter. I want to say just before the 6 minutes expires that these are wonderful people I wrote about, and there's a lighthearted feeling about them, and they were funny, and they're good-natured, and they're, as I said, they're kind and they're humble, but they're not somber, serious folks. Much of the book is really about kind of the lighter side of kind people. It could be a rattlesnake catcher, a guy who hunted rattlesnakes all his life. It took me rattlesnake hunting, and we're walking around and we haven't found any rattlesnakes yet. And he turns to me suddenly and says, with a completely straight face and no sense of irony, he says, you know, another good thing about rattlesnake hunting. And I said, what's that? And he said, it's never crowded. So I met a wonderful woman. I wrote a magazine story years ago about a lady named Edna Koenig, who she and her husband Henry had turned their house into a bird hospital. And this was their little niche of kindness in the world. They took care of wounded birds. I wrote an article about them for Parade magazine. And then that was prior to going to the Journal. And years later, I had a wonderful day with them. And try to cut this short. They, among all these other birds that were flying freely around their house, cedar waxwings, homing pigeons, mourning doves, all over the house. So you can imagine it was an interesting scene. I wrote a column, an article about them for the magazine, rather. Years later, I went back. I'd seen Henry, the Edna's husband, had died. So I went back years later, just stopped in to see how they were doing. And I wondered, they had a robin whose name cleverly was Robbie. And he kind of followed me around the house. And it was clear that he was sort of a surrogate child for the Koenigs. So let me just read a little bit from the chapter. The chapter is actually called Love is Still Love, Even When It's Frozen. Years later, I came across Henry's obituary. Not long after that, when I was in the neighborhood, I decided to stop and pay my respects. The plaque announcing the birdhouse was still in place. Edna answered the doorbell and invited me inside. She was out of the bird-saving business. Henry's absence was palpable, and with all due respect to her late husband, so was Robbie's. Edna and I talked about Henry mostly. At one point, she insisted, I have cake and ice cream in the kitchen, just like that day years earlier when I had visited them. And we sat it down at the kitchen table. I remembered old Robbie trying to mooch a bite. I asked gently, respectfully, the way a person asks a mother about an absent child, whatever became of your boy Robbie? Oh, he died, replied Edna. Frankly, I was a little taken aback by the buoyant tone of her voice. I mean, Robbie had been a surrogate child to the Koenigs, and now he was gone, as was Henry, and Edna was left alone. I'm sorry to hear that, I said. I'm sure you miss him. I do, replied Edna. Then, just as quickly, she asked, would you like to see him? Of course, I answered. I figured that, like most serious pet lovers, Edna was about to show me a snapshot of the late lamented Robbie, maybe from his first communion or in his graduation gown. I knew I was wrong when she headed for the freezer, pushed a bag of lima beans and mixed vegetables aside, and withdrew what looked to be a frozen box of Hallmark greeting cards. She walked over and placed the box ever so gently on the kitchen table next to my cake plate. The top was clear plastic, but covered with a crusty layer of frost. Slowly, Edna began to scrape the ice with her fingernails. In an instant, the dignified image of old Robbie, eternally resting on a bed of artificial Easter grass, appeared. I felt just a tad queasy. I was sure I had seen a weird scene like this in a movie. I figured this sweet little old lady was about to pull a gun, usher me down the basement stairs, where she would put one shot in the nape of my neck, and then freeze me, too, simply for the pleasure of my company. When he died, I couldn't bear to part with him, she explained, looking at the frozen bird lying in repose. And then I thought, why not just freeze him? So I did. This way, whenever I want to see him, all I have to do is pull him out of the freezer. It was odd, I thought, but I had seen stranger things in my lifetime. I stared at the box. The frost was quickly turning to little lumps of water. There was Robbie at rest, stiffer than a frozen mackerel. At the time, I thought it was pretty peculiar, but a few decades removed, I have decided that it was odd, but also sort of sweet. Anyway, you had to concede one thing. Old man Robbie didn't look any the worse for wear. He looks good, doesn't he? Edna asked. For some reason, it reminded me of my father's wake. My dad had been a big man, diminished by illness. He weighed over 225 pounds most of his adult life. Lying in his silk-lined casket, he might have been 100 pounds. I hardly recognized him. And I remember standing in the greeting line next to the casket as people walked by. And what did many of them remark, not knowing what to say at that moment? The same nonsensical thing that people always say in this situation. Your dad looks good. He looks really good. Of course, he didn't look good at all. He looked long gone. And so I instantly strung together a similar string of awkward sentences in Ed McCaney's kitchen that day. "He looks great," I said. "The bird looks just great." And the truth was, old Robbie did look pretty good. That cheeky bird hadn't aged a day. I half expected him to get up and go for my cake.
Steve Hanna, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you this morning, as it always is. And I'd like to invite you back sometime in the near future, if you would be so kind as to join us. But we do have to go right now. I'd like to thank you again for being with us, Steve. I'd like to thank all our listeners for being with us. And one of the things that I going back to the mission of this show about helping people to protect and enhance their investment in real estate right here in Western New York, one thing that I draw from what you say, Steve, is that our values affect value, and I believe they do, and that's why we have such a great community. Thank you for being with us, Steve. I want to wish everybody a very happy holiday season. We'll be back in next week at the same time. And remember, when it comes to real estate, all of upstate is Hunt Country.